told me.
Back on Downtown's 5:35 on a Tuesday afternoon. Well, some 51 years ago, hundreds of thousands of people gathered in upstate New York at Yasgur's Farm for a celebration of music and peace. Our next guest was there. Mike Greenblatt is a music journalist, the author of Woodstock 50th. Back to Yasgur's Farm. And Mike, I say you were there, unlike Joni Mitchell, who wasn't there, but still wrote the song about it.
Well, she desperately wanted to be there. But she had to do the Dick Cavett show in the morning, and her manager, Elliot Roberts, said, "No, I'm afraid you're not going to be able to get out of there." So she sat in that suite at the Sherry Netherland on Central Park West with that big baby grand piano, and her boyfriend Graham Nash went on to make history. And when they got back, she played them this song, sort of dark, minor key song, and that's when Stephen Stills said, "Can we use that song?"
Well, you were there 51 years ago, and I was looking at the calendar and checking on things, and it was actually 51 years ago today that Jimi Hendrix did his thing that made him so famous.
That is correct. He rewrote the Star Spangled Banner, where you could actually hear the bombs bursting in air. It was a seminal moment in the history of rock and roll. And one of the promoters, John Morris, told me a great story. He had fallen asleep under the stage after putting out fires all weekend. The governor wanted to send in the National Guard to disperse us at the butt of a rifle. There was live wires where the topsoil frayed, and he was afraid of a mass electrocution. So many fires he had to put out. But then he realized when the Star Spangled Banner woke him up, and it was the light of day, that they had successfully pulled this off against all odds, and he went out walking. And it was like a battlefield after the Civil War. He expected to find bodies. He didn't find any bodies, just a lot of garbage. But, that walk symbolized the fact that they pulled off the impossible.
We've talked to so many people who were there, people like music journalist Ellen Sander, Stu Cook of CCR, Henry Gross, of course, and yourself. And everybody's got a story of how they got there. What was that adventure like for you in just getting to Woodstock?
Well, we weren't going to go. Anyone that lived in North Jersey at the time was going to go see Led Zeppelin at the convention hall and down the shore, or go to Woodstock. And we kept hearing the advertisements on the FM radio, and that's when we realized, oh, we had to go. All of our favorite bands on one stage in one weekend. So the ticket was $17.50 for all 3 days, and we drove up there on Thursday. No problem until we got to that 17B where we were stopped for so long we played a game of Monopoly on the roof of the car before we moved again. But it was, we didn't know what we were getting into. Nobody did.
1968 into 1969, this country was as divided as it had been probably since the Civil War. We may be back there again. What was it that allowed so many people to not just come together, but come together peacefully for those few days?
Well, you know, we went, like in the Paul Simon song, we went looking for America. We went looking for like-minded people that shared our outrage over an illegal and immoral war in Vietnam, outrage over civil rights. As you say, 68 was a horrible year. The twin assassinations, the Democratic National Convention with the riots, more Americans killed in Vietnam than any other year. But we found common ground with each other, and despite horrible conditions, hey, we're called the Peace and Love Generation. We proved it those 4 days, and we knew the world was watching.
How important was music in uniting the Woodstock generation?
Well, the music was the key. I learned at Woodstock, and I kept this with me the rest of my life, that as long as the music's playing, everything's going to be all right. I mean, when the monsoon came on Sunday, and we didn't have any music for like 3-4 hours, that was tough. It wasn't fun anymore. But when the music came back, the first band was Country Joe and the Fish, and he did the Fish cheer for the second time that weekend, and it's, of course, hilarious and liberating to shout out that word. It wasn't fish. It was another four-letter word starting with F. But the point is that it bonded us together, and it was the music that was important. And I realized then, as I do now, that as long as the music's playing, everything will be all right.
And few people prove that as much at Woodstock as Richie Havens.
Yeah. he was brave because the show was supposed to start at 10 a.m. on Friday. Well, 8 hours later, at 5 p.m., there still was no music. And John Morris and some of the other promoters were desperately trying to get someone on the stage, and they were afraid. They were horribly afraid to go out first. And Richie Havens said, fine. That's when he extemporaneously wrote that Freedom song. And he was pounding his guitar so hard, so violently, he broke a string. And he just casually fixed the string on stage and talked to all those people as if it was a backyard party.
What was your most memorable experience, a performance or otherwise, from Woodstock?
Well, performance, it had to be Sly and the Family Stone. I never heard in my life at that point the kind of heavy rock, funk, soul craziness. And when it was like 3 a.m, and Sly was shouting at us to throw up the peace sign. I know it sounds corny 51 years later, but back then it was cool. We threw up the peace sign and we chanted higher, higher. It was a great liberating moment that I'll remember for the rest of my life.
What have you learned 51 years later that we can apply today? What were the lessons of Woodstock that can still teach us?
Well, peace, basically. Every year around this time, I promote peace and love because that's what we achieved. The food ran out, the water ran out, the bathrooms were overflowing. It was horribly hot, yet then the very next day it was pouring and it was tremendously cold. And we were trapped and all our stuff was back at the car. We didn't even know where the car was. The lessons learned is that 500,000 people can police themselves. There was not one reported instance of violence, yet there were no police. Everyone helped each other. And again, it's cliche, but we helped each other. We fed each other. We kept each other warm. We kept each other high and happy and grooving to the music. It was a 60s moment in time that could never be repeated.
An important lesson, too, I would have to think, is the value of listening to young people and valuing their opinion.
Oh, no doubt about it. We see it today with the protests. Us protesters back in 68, I mean, hey, I linked arms with strangers in Washington, D.C. and shouted, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today regarding the Vietnam War? But nothing changed. We weren't successful in changing the country. But these kids today, they're getting results, and they're getting it fast. The people in Congress are listening to them. The country's listening to them. I'm very impressed, and I must say my daughter's one of them, of the level of activism among young people today.
We're talking with Mike Greenblatt here on Downtown. I want to switch gears a little bit to Bruce Springsteen's wonderful and powerful song, The Rising, was used to such great effect last night in the opening night of the Democratic National Convention. You've got a story of your own about hanging out with the boss. Can you talk a little bit about that?
He was the big Jersey star. I was the editor of the Aquarian Weekly, yet he had never given us an interview. The Aquarian Weekly was New Jersey's alternative weekly. So I went to a pros, invited to a press party for him in New York City on the occasion of the release of Darkness on the Edge of Town. And I buttonholed him. And I go, Bruce, you're the big Jersey guy. I'm the Jersey editor. How come you never spoke with us? And he wasn't even aware that he never spoke with us. And he collared his publicist and he goes, Glenn, get me to do an interview with the Aquarian. And Glenn goes, but Bruce, you're on a six-month tour, and you only have one day off in 6 months, and it's your birthday. He goes, I don't care. I'll spend my birthday with the guy. I owe him this one. And he goes, I can't do it. I can't do it. So Bruce surreptitiously takes me in the corner of the room, and he goes, listen, I'll meet you to the bench to the left of the casino arena at 3 o'clock on September 29th, which was his September 30th, it was his 29th birthday, and he arrived with no publicist. We spent the whole day bumper cars, wrestling in the sand, driving around. It was awesome, and we did it because he was that nice a guy.
And our friend Ken Franklin tells me there may or may not have been a little pinball match as well between the two of you.
I beat him. There's a great picture of me and him, and I'm looking very intense because I really wanted to say that I beat Bruce Springsteen in pinball, and I did.
That's wonderful. Mike, it is great to talk with you, as always. Mike's book is Woodstock 50th, Back to Yasgur's Farm. It's worth a read or a reread if you've already enjoyed it before as we celebrate the events of 1969. Mike, thanks so much for being with us again. We wish you well.
Thanks for having me, man.
Mike Greenblatt here on Downtown.